Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Dr. Peter Bregan. And I have what I think is going to be a very thoughtful hour, an hour about good psychotherapy, what it's about, how you go about it. And I think this is really valuable for people to hear periodically on the show, just a conversation between me and a good therapist, a therapist with his principles and head screwed on right. Before going there, I want to come back to reminding folks about a fundamental principle that I call the brain-disabling principle of psychiatric treatment. Not psychotherapy, but psychiatric treatment. And as some of you know, I've been recently involved in a number of electroshock lawsuits, malpractice suits, and I've been increasingly concerned about the lack of a coherent statement and evidence about the brain damaging effects of ECT that's more up to date than my 2008 book and my 2010 article. And so I put up a website that will be continually evolving called ectresources.org. Now, one of the things the website does is establish the degree to which we can prove that ECT works by disabling the brain. There's some very supposedly sophisticated research going on now, almost all of it by ECT advocates, showing that the electroencephalogram, the brain waves, are changed dramatically for persistent periods of time after ECT, sometimes as far as measured into the future. There's other studies showing that after ECT, patients develop new brain cells. Neurogenesis, which was thought not to previously exist, but we now know on occasion develops in the brain. Others showing that ECT causes an increased production of something called the brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. I've just come across another new study showing that after ECT, the kidney control can be thrown off by an excess production of, or actually reduction in the antidiuretic hormone. So in effect, you go into diuresis, your urine isn't as well concentrated. That's a central brain disorder. Now, if you look at all these things, neurogenesis or the brain-derived neurotrophic factor increasing or the changes in the EEG and so on and on, these are all signs of brain damage, trauma to the brain. And sometimes you can find that coming up in the literature right out of the journals that promote ECT, that these effects are like brain lesions. Well, what does it mean? The ECT docs say it means that ECT works. Look at the changes it's producing. They must be therapeutic. But only somebody weirded out by years of abusing other human beings or participating in twisted, distorted, abusive research would come to such a conclusion when what we're seeing is a pattern of brain damage. And that's the effect. For several weeks, up to 4 weeks after ECT, patients are so demoralized, so brain injured, so apathetic, so unable to have their feelings, that they're rated improved by these soulless investigators and doctors, and soulless they are, to come to the conclusion they do and to inflict the treatments that they do. But this principle that psychiatric treatments, biological psychiatry, that these treatments work by disabling and inevitably injuring the brain applies to every single intervention. Psychosurgery, which still goes on somewhat in North America, obviously the same thing. You basically ruin the frontal lobes and call it an improvement because the person's less in touch with themselves, less able to feel, and unfortunately less able to really function as a human being. But the drugs do the same thing. The antipsychotic drugs lobotomize. They disrupt dopamine function, among other things, and dopamine are the main neuropathways to the brain, and also the main neuropathways disrupted by psychosurgery and also by ECT. We even have studies now showing that. Functional MRI showing that the frontal lobes get disconnected from the rest of the brain as a result of ECT. Of course, that's called an improvement too. All the drugs work by reducing brain function and hence the responsiveness of the human being. And folks need a grounding in this. You know, those of you who are therapists or advocates, don't ignore these principles. Learn more about them. Become an expert in how psychiatric treatments really work so that you can tell other folks about it. It's time for therapists to stop withholding information. It's time for therapists to get engaged and counselors and family members and patients, all engaged in this process of dealing with the psychiatric establishment and protecting vulnerable patients from brain injury in the name of treatment. So that's my introduction for today. Bob Witchell, are you with us today?
I'm here, and I'm listening to every word you're saying, Peter.
Good. Bob is someone I'm looking forward to talking with some more. I think you'll enjoy this conversation and benefit from it, whatever direction you're coming in, because it's really about therapy, and therapy is really about life. Those things, they're in it. You can't separate out therapy and life. And Bob Witchell knows that, and we're going to talk about things like that. It's Robert Witchell, and his last name is spelled W-I-T-C-H-E-L, Witchell. And Bob is a professor of counseling. He's always apparently or mostly taught in counseling departments, much as I have, because those are the least contaminated by psychiatry and the most in touch with basic human principles around the country. The counseling departments, certainly not all of them. And he's in private practice. He's in Pennsylvania. I'll let him tell you how you can get in touch with him and where his office is. Bob's basic principles from his website are identical to, or nearly identical to, pretty much what every good therapist nowadays is promoting. And one of the principles is the value of connecting with the person, their pain, and their joy. And he says that you do that rather than relegating them to diagnoses and symptoms. Another is the value of sharing his own struggles and triumphs and joining with the person in their life journey. I do that too, by the way. I want you to know I don't sit back like some wise Yoda and make an occasional pronouncement. I share when I think it's useful to the other human being, not useful to me necessarily, but useful to the other person to hear that their own struggles are shared and their therapist is not immune to being a human being. Another principle that he comes right out and has on the web, that the medication is often used as a quick fix, and how diagnosis can easily result in creating distance between people. He also talks about how too many mental health professionals are out of touch with their clients, not aware of their own stuff either, he says. And then the importance of my own ongoing personal growth. I hope that increasingly therapists will also put up even more daring statements like, at the least, psychiatric drugs not encouraged and maybe even discouraged. Hi, Bob. What you doing? What you want to talk about to start off today?
Well, just to say, first of all, the information that you just referred to on my website, that's not new. It's the same information I've had on that website for about 30 years.
That's
of course,
fabulous.
It's before the web even existed, but that's the same information I had in a brochure in 1981. So this is not new for me. And when I meet with people the first time, often they'll tell me that they have been to some other therapist, and I ask them how it went. And they say, well, they didn't say much. They nodded their head. They said hello. Sometimes they fell asleep. They repeated what I said, and I didn't feel like I really got very much. The other thing that I ask people these days is, are you on medication? And about 10 to 15 years ago, only about 10 to 15% would say they're on psychiatric medication of some kind. Today, that's between 80 and 90% say that they're on medication in their first session, and most of them have been prescribed this medication by their PCPs, their primary care physicians. So certainly a huge increase in the number of people who are on some type of medication. I can talk about any number of things. First of all, what you were saying, people are not their diagnosis. And I think that's too often the case in the mental health field, that whether you're psychiatrists or psychologists or others, social workers, they often communicate with each other through diagnoses, and they don't really talk about the people underneath those diagnoses. When people come in, they will often say they're depressed or they're anxious. And to me, that means that they're alive. Those are parts of being alive, parts of life, to be depressed or sad or anxious. And I believe that as children, we're taught to be afraid of our feelings. And so we want to get away from them as quickly as possible. But that's also true for people in the mental health field. They've been taught the same thing as children. And so they want to somehow eradicate the feelings as quickly as possible, and I think that's why people are given drugs. That's one way that that's done. For me, the feelings are our body's way of letting us know that we need to pay attention to something that's going on in our life. And if we ignore the feelings, they're going to continue to be there, and they're going to increase until we address them. The drugs just repress the feelings. And I tell people who I meet with, including my students who I teach, that your feelings are important, and let's explore them and see what they're all about. And I think that's one of the reasons why I've been pretty successful in helping people to resolve significant issues in their life. And not necessarily need some battery of or regimen of medication to do it. So I could go on, or if you have some questions or issues.
I think you're doing great, by the way. I'm very glad to hear everything you're saying. How do you deal with the patient who is on drugs? A lot of therapists are really afraid to voice an opinion, and that fear, by the way, is largely unfounded if you're in private practice. Mm-hmm. Therapists almost never get sued. I don't know of any recent cases at all in the last years. for not recommending medication or for being critical of medication or anything about medication that they might say or do. I'm just not getting feedback, or that therapists are getting sued, and I'd be a lightning rod. A lot of people would come to me if they were getting sued, you know, for having been critical of meds. But most therapists live in fear of expressing anything to their patients that's not positive toward meds, like stay on your meds. And I'm just very much want to see therapists learning about drugs, learning how they disable the brain, and being able to share with patients what their drugs are really doing to them. But how do you handle that, and how would you want to ideally handle issues surrounding medication with your patients?
Well, I try to see what their experience is on the drugs. A young man I've been meeting with recently, when he first came to see me, he was having some anxiety. He wasn't on any drug, and ended up going to a mental health center to meet with someone. And of course, I don't think that a psychiatrist ever met with him. I think what happened was a nurse practitioner or physician's assistant who's working off of a protocol, anxiety means this drug, so that's what we're going to give him. So he ended up on a drug. And as he continued to come in to meet with me, I was saying, well, how's the drug making you feel? Well, I get jittery now. I'm not sleeping as well. I'm putting on some weight. So I go back to him and say, well, is this what you wanted for your life? If not, maybe this is not the best approach for you to be on this drug. And maybe you can go back to the person that put you on it and give them this feedback and tell them you want them to help you get off now that they've put you on it. Because I certainly don't want to be the person that said, well, I think you need to begin to decrease this. That's not my area of expertise. And so he has now gone back to them. I haven't seen him again to see what the outcome was. But that's what I've done in the past. I also utilize an MD I'm in the Pittsburgh area, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and I utilize an MD who's not a psychiatrist but who does integrative and complementary medicine so that she can begin to help people take a look at all their health issues and help them truly deal with what may be going on in their body that could be contributing to their anxiety, whether their thyroid is off, whether they have blood sugar problems or other deficiencies. And at the same time, she can help them begin to wean off some of the medications that they're on. But I typically do not keep quiet about my opinions about the drugs. And I will tell them about the website SSRI Stories, which I'm sure you're familiar with. I assume the audience may not be, but many, many stories that have been linked on that website. The website was created by, I think it was Sarah Bostock, after her daughter died as a result of Paxil overdose, but not because she was taking too much Paxil. Her body wasn't processing it. So I want them to get educated and go out to the Internet and find information for themselves and see if that's what they want for them, or do they want to really try to find out what the anxiety is about.
Well, I think what you're saying is very important in two ways. First, I think it's a really good idea for those of you out there who are thinking about becoming non-medical therapists or are therapists, that you look around for somebody who is an MD or a nurse practitioner or a physician's assistant, depending on your state. These people have different kinds of abilities to prescribe. And reach out, look around, go on the Internet, ask your friends, and see if you can find a local prescriber. Again, it can be a family doc, it can be a DO, it can be a nurse practitioner, it could be a physician's assistant, somebody who can write those scripts in your state and work with them with your patients to come off medication. That is absolutely, unquestionably good practice. I don't see any way, if you're behaving responsibly and you like your patients and they like you, that you're going to run into any trouble for that. And I've never heard of anyone running into trouble for that. My second thing is to ask you, Bob, have you gotten into difficulty of any kind over many years now of voicing your opinions about meds?
No, I think that sometimes some of my students who have been in the field for a while, they begin to hear what I'm saying, and at first they think, what's he talking about? This is heresy. How can he be teaching in a mental health counseling program and telling us a story about medication that isn't by the book that people have been living by all these years? And so I begin to give them more information. Mostly people, including folks in the field, are lacking information. They don't know. But I haven't gotten into difficulty. There was a time period when I was working in a mental health center in a southern state and back in the 70s, and I started to get information about orthomolecular psychiatry, the Abram Hoffers, who were doing some very different kinds of things than straight medication, and it was working, and so I started to look for an orthomolecular psychiatrist. And one of our psychiatrists in the mental health center heard about this, and he raised an issue, like, what was I trying to do? I got an interesting letter back from one of the top names in the orthomolecular psychiatry field who said, you send us a sick doctor, we will fix them, we will make them a believer, and they will turn their whole approach around from the traditional medicine approach that they're currently using. And this came from the Brain Bio Center in Princeton. I don't remember the name of the director of the center at this time.
So you haven't really got hurt for it. I mean, you confidently say that to folks out there. But this is very important.
I haven't been hurt, and if anything, I've actually spoken out what a lot of people were feeling underneath. They began to express their feelings. But I think sometimes they didn't know there was another approach. But what do you do with someone who's depressed other than giving them an antidepressant? Well, you talk to them and you find out what they're depressed about what they can then do to work through some of what has caused their depression. Here's a guy who I worked with many years ago. He was a professor, very smart guy, very depressed, anxious, and he began to explore in some sessions with me some very upsetting childhood memories about his father being someone who must have been crazy. His father would disappear for weeks at a time, and then he would show up back on their doorstep. And then one time he said that his father came back, and some people were called to come get him, and they came and put him in a straitjacket and removed him from their home. And he was only 6 or 7, and it was very devastating for him to see that happen. And I think that's part of what was behind his depression, all of what he went through during his childhood of watching his father go in and out of the home and so forth. The following weekend, without my awareness, he checked himself into a psychiatric unit. And, of course, you know what happened there. 3 or 4 drugs later, 10 days later, 2 weeks later, he's discharged. They tell him not to meet with me anymore because clearly I was bringing up stuff from his life that was causing him to get even more depressed, when I actually feel like I was bringing up the issues that had some of the roots of the depression. So they told him not to see me, but occasionally I would see him around town, and he looked drugged, disconnected, he had gained a lot of weight, He was still very sad, but that's what their approach did to him. And it's very sad. It just didn't work. And I don't know if he ever explored the childhood memories. On the other hand, working in an inpatient unit myself back in the 90s, there was a woman who was molested by her older brother. This is an inpatient group that I ran every week. And there were always different people in the group because people would only stay in the hospital at that time 7 to 14 days at best. So she talked about how her older brother had molested her in the basement of her home. And I asked her if she would be willing to revisit one of the abuse scenes, and she said she would. So I asked her if she would close her eyes and try to get back into what occurred. And she said she was in her kitchen, went to the, as an adult in her 40s, she went to the door of the kitchen that led to the basement where the abuse was taking place. She opened the door and described seeing her brother on top of a child that she could barely see because her brother was so much bigger. And now at 275 pounds in her 40s, she starts to walk down those steps. The brother turns around, sees her. He has fear on his face. She gets down there. She pulls him off of the little girl, throws him across the room, something that she's probably wanted to do for 35, 40 years, then picks up the little girl, holds her, and carries her back out of the basement for safety, to safety. And she felt so relieved after doing that. Now, that's not magic, and it only took about 5 minutes to do, but it got her get in touch with some anger and some compassion that had been stuck inside of her for a long, long time.
That's a lovely vignette. And I think that reliving in a positive, manageable way abuse is extraordinarily important as a part of therapy for many, many people. And I think the way you portray it is very important, and I want to note that that you want to do that when the person's ready and able to go back and not be overwhelmed by the experience, but to go back and to manage the experience. I think that's a very important part of that. And occasionally I've made miscalculations where I thought somebody was ready to look at something and they weren't. And at that point you can actually, you know, do something of a disservice because the person's not ready to manage the feelings, make them get worse overnight. And
right.
I always take that as a sign that I've been too encouraging, or I just didn't pick up the signals that the person wasn't ready yet to go back and look. And that's it. The way you described that is a very good example of how to go about it, and it's really good work. Do you encourage all of your patients to look at childhood trauma?
I usually ask if there was any trauma. I also ask about early losses, grief, because I think so many of us walk around with those types of repressed childhood experiences, and they work at people. I noticed that in the hospital, there were many women being admitted, and I started to ask them, what age were they abused? Were they first abused? And they would say 8, 12, whatever age. And then I said, do you have any children? And it would usually be the case, which surprised me at first, that their oldest daughter had reached the age that they were when the abuse occurred in their own life, and that started to trigger something, but they never made the connection.
I think that's a very real and common phenomenon.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, I think
so. It can induce panic into a person about themselves, about their daughters or their sons. They can get scared for themselves, for their children, and not even know why.
Yeah.
Well, I like the way you talk about therapy. We're going to be going to break now. I'm talking with Bob Witchell, W-I-T-C-H-E-L. If you go onto the website, onto the Internet, look for Robert Witchell. No, he's not the one who's a car racer. He's the really kind and pleasant-looking gentleman who's the third one in the row of Bob Witchell. Bob, let's come back and talk some more in a few minutes.
Okay, I look forward to it.
And this is Peter Bregan again, and I'm here with Bob Witchell, a psychologist, psychotherapist in the Pittsburgh area. Bob, how do people get in touch with you?
Well, my website is easy. It's Witchell, W-I-T-C-H-E-L, web, W-E-B, .com. And my email address is Witchell at yahoo.com, so that's easy. And my office number is 412-252-2450.
Unless you have something burning on your mind from the break, I'd like to, at some point, get to talk about people who are seriously suffering. Because often the idea is, well, the kind of therapy we're talking about, that's, you know, that's for folks who are functioning on a high level. But what about the suicidally depressed person who's barely making it to your office? How about the person who's hallucinating and seeing things, hearing things, or the person who's got ideas, the persecution that are obviously irrational and very harmful to them? So I'd like to at some point get to talk about that and whether you deal with folks who are having that much trouble, unless you have something else you want to start.
Let me tell you about this girl I saw years ago who was 16. And if her quick history doesn't tell you that she had some serious stuff going on, I'm not sure what will. She was discharged from an inpatient hospital. I saw her there just very briefly in a morning group that was a check-in group, but I never really talked to her. But something must have happened that when she got discharged, her mother contacted me. In less than 2 years, she had 8 hospital stays at 4 different hospitals, all inpatient psychiatry, 11 different diagnoses, and more than 16 psychiatric drugs in under 2 years. So, and some of the diagnoses were clearly the schizophrenic and more serious types of diagnoses. I don't know how they did accurate diagnosing, because a lot of it may have even been coming from side effects from drugs that she was on. So they weren't really seeing her for who she really is. But within a 6-month period of time that I began to meet with her, her mother had weaned her off the last few drugs that she was on. I think she felt heard by me, and I think that's the most important thing, that people feel heard. And she began to become homeschooled. She eventually got a part-time job. She had a boyfriend. And she came back to life. She had to mostly deal with the trauma of so many hospitalizations and how she was treated in the hospital. So even a person who may be hearing voices, maybe those voices are there for a reason, and they're trying to tell them something. And so let's talk about the voices and what the voices are saying. Let's engage the voices. When I used to work in mental health outpatient, I would think, well, the really so-called crazy people were in the hospital, so I really wasn't seeing them. So then I worked in a hospital, and I kept looking for the really crazy people. I think the people who were the craziest were having effects from years of medication. But when I would sit down with someone who the staff would say, well, they're not really good for your group, but we want them to come once. And this woman who never spoke, had been in the hospital all the time, sat in one of my groups, and they were, again, childhood abuse groups, mostly sexual abuse. And after someone had shared a lot and cried and worked through a little bit of the abuse in their life, she perked up and she said, you know, I was abused when I was a child. And she began talking about it. And then after she talked some, I said, you know, you have all those staff out there on the unit fooled. They think you're crazy. But really, you're a human being that has had troubles, and you've never had the opportunity to talk about them. And I think that goes back to the story that you tell in the first chapter of Toxic Psychiatry about the work that you and your undergraduate peers did at Met, I think it was Metro State or Met State, the back ward people who allegedly are so crazy, but all it took was some care and nurturing and listening to them. And I think that's really what it takes. Now, I think also helping people make connections to unfinished business in their life that they need to take care of. So there's some of that that needs to take place, too.
I think that, in my experience, that the most disturbed folks are the ones who can most benefit from a simple, caring, supportive relationship, mm-hmm. the bedrock of psychotherapy, because their lives have been largely devoid of a caring, loving, unconditional relationship. Mm-hmm. And they certainly were devoid of it in the early years of their lives. And what they had later on may not have been able to take well because of the early experiences. So I deeply experience and believe that the principles that we talk about as being good for psychotherapy, being real, being honest, self-disclosing if it's helpful to the other person, not keeping your distance, but being present as a human being, not diagnosing, not drugging, that these principles are even more effective, more obviously, for really injured souls who will respond often with deep gratitude for an opportunity to have a different kind of relationship. And I really want those of you listening who are injured, or those of you listening who offer various kinds of services to people, to really know that the basics of human relationship are healing, and that that's the start of it all. It can be useful to go back and relive trauma and to do things like that. But even that, I believe, is only effective in the context of a caring relationship, because it's our caring which transforms the person's experience of the trauma from something they deserved to something that no one deserved. It's our presence as a caring person that lets them see they were genuinely abused and taken advantage of. And, Bob, I'm sure that makes sense to you.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was a child who I never met, but I also did some work on a child and adolescent unit, and I was sitting looking at her chart. She was 5 years old. And in the chart, it says that she had reported being sexually offended in some way. Immediately after reading the chart, and I guess I was going to meet with her that day, but I don't recall ever meeting with her. But I attended a staffing about her, and this young psychiatrist, straight out of medical training, began to talk about her and said that she clearly, in his mind, had childhood schizophrenia. And so I got internally very distressed about someone making that kind of a diagnosis so quickly. And I don't know what kind of contact he even had with her. So I said that I was curious, and I said, Dr. So-and-so, what do you think came first, the childhood schizophrenia or the sexual abuse? and he stopped in his tracks, and he acknowledged that I made a good point, and the conversation went off in a completely different direction than where he was heading. But just giving someone that diagnosis could easily impact her entire life, starting at 5 years old. And I don't think that some people who work in this field recognize that strong impact that one single decision can make about someone.
Yes, if that doctor had had his way, and perhaps he did in the long run, because that doctor is everywhere and is everyone
right.
in psychiatry, that person got labeled not as a victim of child abuse, but as a schizophrenic.
Mm-hmm.
And I think whenever you get to know someone, in my experience, who we would ordinarily call psychotic, whenever you get to know someone like that, you get to know somebody who has been deeply, deeply injured in their childhood.
Right.
And it can be a simple abandonment, lack of love, so that the person does get a chance to develop the basic security and sense of self. It can be accompanied by physical abuse, sexual abuse, emotional abuse, which is, by the way, of course, one package as a rule and not three separate entities. It all goes together, fixed
right.
physical, sexual, and emotional abuse. And to a great extent, everything we're looking at in very distressed people is a form of post-traumatic response to horrible trauma, including abandonment and lack of love as a child.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I have these two dolls that are in my office, and I don't use them that often, but occasionally I do. Because when someone is in my office, no matter what age they are, their child is in that office too, inside of them. And so sometimes it's easier for someone to reach out to their child if they're reaching out to a doll that may be representative of them as a child. And so I'll use those dolls when it calls for it. I was thinking of a woman who was in her 50s, and I worked with about 10, 15 years ago, and some family members were dying. Her father had already passed away. Her brother had died. And she said in the first session, "Why do I live with a life of grief?" Well, it was right at the end of the session. So in the second session, we explored that some more, and she said when she was 5 years old, she lived in the city, and she was leaving her backyard, and the backyard was up against an alley, and her three-year-old brother must have followed her out of the backyard into the alley, and she didn't know it, and he was immediately hit by a car, by a drunk driver. And he was killed. And she always felt that it was her fault. But the thing she said was, no one ever talked to her about it. Not as a child, not as a teenager. Never, ever did anyone ever talk about this and how it impacted her. She never went to the cemetery until she was in her 40s. So for 35 years, she stayed away from her brother's grave. So on the day of her brother's death, she felt like she needed to be held. So I brought these two dolls, the same two dolls I have now, and I said, one represents your brother, and the other one represents you. And I sat them in two chairs opposite her, and she began to talk with each of them. She got into a lot of pain. She expressed her pain. She told her brother how much she cared about him, and held the little boy doll as she was telling him that, because she never had a chance to tell him that. And she told him that she was sorry that he followed her out and that he was hit by that car. And then she did the other important work, and that is to hold the girl doll and do the very thing that she needed from 50 years earlier, for someone to hold her. And there was more tears. And she felt so relieved And this then prompted some conversations that she had with her mother, who was dying. They talked about that day, and I imagine the mother had held in a lot of feelings too. So it had a benefit to not only her, but other family members. She didn't need any drugs. She didn't need shock. And she dealt with probably the most critical life experience she ever had. And it was beautiful to see.
Yeah, it's very beautiful. And, you know, as you know, traumatic loss is one of the most mm-hmm. devastating experiences in human life. In this case, the loss of her little brother, in many cases, parents losing children. I'm sure her parents were going through profound loss and didn't right. have the wherewithal, perhaps, to relate to her sufficiently at that time. Mm-hmm. We're basically talking about unrelenting bereavement, which right. now, of course, according to the new DSM-5, bereavement is a mental illness to be treated exactly like major depressive disorder, which will just make docs more comfortable with what they're already doing, which is drugging people moments after they've experienced a dreadful loss, rather than helping them go through a bereavement process. And in this case, you allowed bereavement to begin to take place. Your patient for the first time began to be able to grieve what had happened, including almost inevitably the guilt that people feel as a part of bereavement. I love the way you talk about therapy.
Thanks.
We've got about 10 minutes left, maybe a little fewer. I'm happy to just have you talk some more about these examples if you
okay.
have more in mind.
Well, you know, something I thought might be useful to bring up, many of the people who end up in graduate programs in mental health, whether it's psychiatry or social work or counseling or psychology, they also have their journeys that they've taken. Sometimes they've had many challenges in their own lives. But that doesn't mean they've resolved those issues in their own life. So they want to help others, but they may not have even helped themselves enough yet. And so, like, for instance, I'm going to be teaching a grief counseling class beginning next Tuesday for 5 weeks. And I usually say at the beginning of that class, you are going to talk about bereavement and loss that you've experienced in your own life. And they look at me, oh, okay, sure, we're going to talk about our own loss. And then by the end of the class, they recognize that that's what we spent a good bit of our time on, not just talking about theories of bereavement and loss, but also how they've dealt with it. They will write a paper about their own losses in their own life and how they feel like they've been impacted by it. I tell students when they first come into the graduate program, and I've been teaching in this program for over 25 years, and I tell them on the first night in a class that I might have with them, you will be different 2.5 years from now when you graduate from this program. I know you're going to be different. And there are certain things that happen for them during that program that helps them to focus on who they are as human beings, what their journey has been to this point, and how they can become more fully healthy, emotionally healthy people. We can only take our clients as far as we've gone, and I'm sure you've written about that in many places. I've seen when I do supervision of students that they're particularly troubled by a client that they're working with. And I'll say, who's that client reminding you of? Is there anybody in your own life? And they hadn't thought of it, but as soon as I ask the question, they'll say, oh, you know, I have an aunt that's just like this client. And I can't stand my aunt. And here's all the reasons why. And I'll say, well, how can you get past that and see this person for who they are, if they're reminding you of all the feelings you have about your aunt, but you haven't been conscious of it. So this is a very important part of training in the counseling field. I don't think psychiatrists get that. They just get their diagnosis and treatment regimens and drugs. And psychologists learn how to assess people. But I think the counselors are more likely to get some of these kinds of skills. But unless a graduate program really focuses on personal development, too, then they're only going to learn it from the book, and they're not going to know it. They're not going to embody the personal growth process that they need to serve as a guide for their clients to do. Now, one of the things I do is I'll take groups of students on a one-day outdoor adventure experience. One of the things that they're asked to do there by choice is to get up on a platform and 5 feet off the ground. And a colleague of mine, we work with people to help them get in touch with what it's like to be up there and to see people down below who are going to catch them. And there are 10 people who are standing there looking like they're ready to catch this person. Some people never even do the fall, but just to have 10 people there ready to receive them is something they've never had happen in their entire life. And it can bring up a lot of feelings and memories for people. And then when they make the fall, if they choose to do it, they're being held by 10 people. And most of us have never experienced being held by 10 people at one time. And that can bring up feelings. And so when these students graduate, sometimes they'll talk about an experience on that ropes course that made an impact on them, and it was the most significant thing that happened in their entire graduate program. And we weren't even in a classroom. So that's something that I've made very important for me as I've been a professor throughout the last 25 years.
Wonderful work, absolutely wonderful work. Last week on my radio show, I had my close friend, dear friend, Joanne Cacciatore from Arizona, who and Arizona State University, who has a network throughout the world that helps people grieve traumatic loss, traumatic bereavement, and it's mostly parents who have lost children. And for those of you listening today, last week's show will elaborate a lot on some of the subjects we're talking about today about bereavement. Now, Bob, you mentioned toxic psychiatry earlier. You've been around a long time. I always enjoy asking my guests, and I don't know the answer generally. I never know it before they come on usually, because they're not friends of mine usually. Most of my guests are folks that are just really good people in the field, not necessarily met them. When did you first become aware of my work, and did it play any role in your life?
Well, I got a copy of Toxic Psychiatry when it came out.
Early 1990s.
Right, I think 1991 or so, yep. And I had read some other books by Eileen Walkenstein.
A friend of mine, by the way.
Who's a psychiatrist. And Beyond the Couch, I think, was a book, one of the books she wrote.
Yep.
And then I came across your book, and I thought, well, here's someone who is not only being critical of what's going on in the field today, but also offering some alternatives. And I happened to speak to an attorney the other day, and I said, I'm going to be on Dr. Peter Bragan's show. And he said, oh, I know him. He was in a case that I was involved with. So, you know, your name is out there to all kinds of folks. And But I include you in many of the statements, particularly in toxic psychiatry, in a number of PowerPoints that I show to my students, because you're very clearly saying a lot that needs to be said, and not enough people are saying it. I do that also with Stanton Peale. You might be familiar with Stanton.
Sure.
He wrote a book called Diseasing of America.
Another guy has been around a long, long time.
Right, he has too. I worked with him on a grant project about 20 years ago, and he came out to the Pittsburgh area. But I'll talk about what he has to say about the drug and alcohol treatment field, and that's a whole other topic. So, but yeah, I've been very drawn to you and your work, and I'm sorry I missed your conference this year, and I blame that on the air traffic controllers, but I intend to be there next year.
You were kind of on your way, weren't you?
That's right, I was.
That's okay. We're not going to be doing a conference in 2014, but I'm going to be at conferences around the country, including one where I'll be featured in Florida. So keep track on our website and my website, Brecken.com, folks, and you can keep track on Facebook, which my wife runs for me. We've got a minute left. Some quick last thoughts on therapy and life.
Well, I think therapy is life, and life is therapy. And they all go together. And when I sit in my office with people, I'm just being with another person and sharing with them and having them talk about their life and help them get through the process and make it a better life.
Robert Witchell, Bob, thank you so much for being on the show, and what a delight to personally be getting to know you better. I think folks out there have also enjoyed that. Thank you very much, Bob.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate it.